can take care of us, of our lands, of our everything. Without them, we are nothing.
The celebration included real footage of past operations during the Israeli occupation of Lebanon, the liberation of most Lebanese land in May of 2000, as well as significant images from the 2006 summer confrontation of the Israeli assaults, and finally the fight against Takfiri terrorists in the eastern border mountains.
Hezbollah says it's celebrating more than a mere date on the calendar as its establishment day. 40 years ago today, the Israeli army, backed by multinational forces, occupied the capital, Beirut. But here, a group of young men believed liberation was possible and achieved the unthinkable. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The British government is facing calls to press for the freedom of a young woman imprisoned in Saudi Arabia over her use of Twitter. Salma Al-Shahab, the 34-year-old mother of two, is a Saudi national who lived and studied in Britain before her arrest whilst visiting family inside Saudi Arabia in January 2021. Salma's original sentence was just 3 years, but earlier this month, an appeals court extended her term, sentencing her to 34 years in prison, followed by a 34-year travel ban.
What's Salma's crime, you may ask? Just a series of Twitter posts and retweets, all of content critical of the Saudi regime. Her sentence is thought to be one of the longest ever doled out by the Saudi authorities against a female human rights activist inside the kingdom.
Activists and lawyers consider her lengthy jail sentence as shocking and outrageous, even by Saudi standards of justice. An opposition Labour MP, Hilary Benn, confirmed via a Twitter post he has sent a letter to Foreign Secretary and Tory leadership hopeful Liz Truss, demanding her intervention to help free the jailed student. As earlier this year, Truss declined to criticise the kingdom for its poor human rights record, saying Riyadh is an important partner of the UK. Critics express concern over not only Saudi rights abuses, but Western countries' double standards too.
I don't think the UK has that much influence at all if Liz Truss is going to try her hand. Of course, what we are seeing is the usual Western double standards. Only a few days before this horrific prison sentence was issued, Joe Biden was standing up for Salman Rushdie and saying that he had a right to free speech, and this was very much part of American values. But obviously those American values don't extend to Salma Al-Shahab.
Ever since Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman became Saudi Arabia's de facto leader in 2017, the kingdom has become even more intolerant of any internal criticism and activism, jailing activists, bloggers, intellectuals, and others for their political activism. International condemnation has done little to stop Saudi's behaviour, including the brutal killing of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi in Istanbul in 2018. Robert Carter, London.
A big conference was held in the Gaza Strip to mark the anniversary of an arson attack on the Al-Aqsa Mosque in 1969. 53 years ago, the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Al-Quds was set on fire by an Australian Zionist named Dennis Michael Rohan in coordination with Israeli officials and military forces. Hundreds of people attended the national conference, which was organized by Palestinian resistance factions. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas warned the Tel Aviv regime against crossing the red lines at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound.
We warned the Zionist enemy against making any stupid moves towards the Al-Aqsa Mosque and Al-Quds. We're willing to sacrifice our lives for the sake of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. We call on all Arab leaders to boycott the Israeli regime because it poses a great threat to all nations.
Soon after the arson attack, the Israeli regime increased the Judaization and Settlement building in Al-Quds. Palestinian officials accused Arab regimes normalizing ties with Tel Aviv of encouraging Israeli attacks against the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
The shameful normalization of ties between Arab countries and the Israeli regime is encouraging our enemy to carry out further attacks against the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Arab governments must stop encouraging the Israeli regime to violate the rights of the Palestinian people and their sacred sites. Al-Quds is the core of the Palestinian struggle.
This year's anniversary comes amid an escalation of Israeli attacks against the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Al-Quds is sacred to all Muslims and Palestinians who consider it as the capital of their future state.
Al-Quds will always be in the heart of the Islamic nation, and all attempts by the Israeli regime to change its status are doomed to fail. On this sad occasion, we call on all Arabs and Muslims to support Al-Quds and to support Palestine.
Occupied by Israeli regime forces in 1967, Al-Quds has been at the heart of the Palestinian struggle for freedom and justice. Observers say the international community has failed to help the Palestinians in Al-Quds and turned a blind eye to Israeli violations against the Al-Aqsa Mosque for decades. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
A timeless beauty that tells stories from Iran's rich artistic heritage. Persian carpets are on display in the 29th Iranian Handwoven Carpet Show in Tehran. The event has brought under one roof producers of hand-woven carpets and pictorial rugs from across the country to showcase their latest designs.
The Persian carpet represents the identity of Iranians. Today, you can see machine-made carpets which are significantly lower in quality compared to the hand-woven ones. So this expo helps reintroduce the importance of hand-woven rugs to the people.
For centuries, the Iranian carpet has represented Iran's culture and art. Its unique design and quality have turned the ancient handicraft into a lucrative commodity on the global stage. Less than three decades ago, this sublime art used to be a major export earner for Iran, a viable source of income that accounted for almost one-fifth of the country's non-oil revenues. But today, this is no longer the case, as producers are warning that the Iranian carpet is losing its shine in the global market. From an annual revenue of up to $1 billion in the 1990s, the export of Iranian carpets has slumped to almost zero. One reason behind this freefall has to do with U.S. sanctions, says carpet trader who used to export to Europe before Washington's anti-Iran measures tightened the screw on the Persian carpet.
In the wake of the sanctions, it's safe to say that our carpet exports have dropped to almost zero. Complications in money transfer are one of the impacts of the sanctions, and the unwillingness of foreign clients to buy from us is the other result, because they fear U.S. punishment if they interact with us.
In 2018, another challenge came into play to knock the Persian carpet out of the global market once and for all. Surprisingly, it's a domestic issue. Since the depreciation of the Iranian rial, the government has imposed tight controls on currency liquidity, which require exporters to return their hard currency proceeds to the country within a very short period of time.
The government is not helping us, yet it's been creating problems for us by the so-called currency treaty. It's impossible to return the proceeds within only 2 months. We need time to sell our carpets in foreign countries where demand for our hand-woven carpets has declined.
The absence of genuine Iranian carpets in the international market has given way to other rivals to fill the void. Countries such as India, Pakistan, and even Afghanistan have since been supplying the market with cheap and fake copies of Iranian carpets, says this young carpet trader.
India, Afghanistan, Pakistan, they are just representing their tableau rugs and carpets with lower prices. The density of their carpets are lower than Iranian carpets, the colors. And also, if you just use them in your houses, you can see that their colors are faded by passing the time.
Representing Iran's heritage and civilization for thousands of years, the Persian carpet has for the past two decades disappeared from many floors and walls. Producers hope that this exhibition would act as a wake-up call for Iranian authorities to take action and dust off all the challenges from the Persian carpet. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Yemeni officials criticize world bodies for lack of transparency in their humanitarian work in the conflict-stricken country. Yemen's Ministry of Human Rights has held a press conference in the capital Sana'a on the occasion of the World Humanitarian Day.
The United Nations is in a state of weakness because it's subject to the conditions and dictates of donors, as it does not have its own resources. The United Nations has never proven its integrity despite receiving huge funds. If the UN is to be effective and impartial, it must have its own resources and grant everyone access to its financial reports, especially those who are receiving aid from the world body.
The ministry says world bodies must publicize their financial reports to prove their integrity. It says those world bodies receive billions of dollars every year from donors to save the lives of millions of Yemenis, but they're not doing much in this regard.
On World Humanitarian Day, we call on international organizations, including the UN, to increase transparency and integrity in their humanitarian activities in Yemen, considering that many Yemenis have not seen the impact of their work and aid. There is massive corruption in international organizations, and therefore, they must disclose their financial reports and explain to everyone how they spend what they get from donors.
Recently, the World Food Program said the cost of the minimum food basket has increased by 74%, and the prices of fuel have doubled across the country. The organization says this will push food insecurity in Yemen to new levels.
Yemenis believe that world bodies, including the United Nations, want the war in Yemen be prolonged so they can ask for more funds for their programs. They say that international bodies have failed to ease the humanitarian situation in their country, despite the fact that they received huge funds to aid Yemen during 7 years of war and siege. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Brazil's presidential frontrunner has pledged to tackle hunger and ensure food security as the country has returned to the United Nations hunger map as a result of the neoliberal policies of his opponent, incumbent Jair Bolsonaro. Former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva says there's no explanation for the dire circumstances within the country.
This has to end because there are 33 million people without enough to eat. There are 105 million people who are suffering from food insecurity. And this country is the third largest food producer in the world. It's the first animal protein producer in the world. There are no reasonable explanation.
Lula da Silva was joined at his first major rally in Brazil's largest city by several towering political figures of the Brazilian left, including former President Dilma Rousseff.
Few days remain for the election, and we're going to have to go out onto the street and convince each and every person for their vote, because right now, voting is the only weapon we have. It's the democratic weapon.
Lula is counting on the support of some of the largest unions and social movements on the continent, whose leaders have vowed to return the Workers' Party to the government.
Right now, 60 million children will go to sleep not knowing if they will have food tomorrow and next week. We live in a country that won't take care of the country's greatest asset, which is its people. A government that doesn't take of its greatest patrimony of human beings is a worthless government.
All polls show former President Lula with a significant margin over Jair Bolsonaro, and Lula is continuing to gain ground and enjoys a higher level of support than the sum of all other candidates combined.
From here, we expect to see Lula embark on a Brazil-wide tour and meet with a range of sectors from which he seeks to lock down support. Camila Escalante from Sao Paulo.
The UK's biggest opposition party has entered into a membership crisis as close to 100,000 members abandoned the party over the past 12 months. On Tuesday, the Electoral Commission revealed that the UK Labour Party's membership fell by more than 91,000 in 2021, with a loss of income from membership fees contributing towards the party's end-of-year financial deficit of £5 million.
The question is, why is there a mass exodus of the Labour Party happening now, especially given the fact that over the past 12 months, it's been the ruling Conservative Party who have been embroiled in the majority of the headline-grabbing scandals? Well, speaking to Press TV, many former Labour members have informed us that it appears to be the direction in which the current leader, Keir Starmer, is taking the party in, which is proving to be a decisive factor for many.
Speaking to a former Labour member, shocking accusations of racism, Islamophobia and a purge of left-wing socialists has left a bitter taste with former Labour loyalists.
It's a witch hunt. There's actually been a witch hunt, and I firmly believe that currently in the Labour Party, they are actively on a witch hunt to wean out anyone who is not in line with their party. The leadership is taking the party down a route of racism, down a route of pure and utter Islamophobia. They're not only losing the minority vote, but they're losing many other people as well.
Labour's membership increased significantly during former party leader Jeremy Corbyn's term, swelling to more than 500,000. The lifelong socialist eventually handed over power following years of stiff rebellions from right-wing Labour MPs, who now head the party. The latest figures raise serious doubts of whether current leader Sir Keir Starmer could win an election when he can't even win the hearts of Labour's own membership. Robert Carter, London.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all. From the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O, the Most Merciful.
Us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Operation against Ukraine continues. This is while the U.S. military support also continues unabated, with the latest support equaling almost another $1 billion. Meanwhile, sanctions and condemnations against Russia have never stopped. For example, the U.K. has stated that Russia has no moral right to sit at the Group of 20 Nations. In this edition of the Spotlight, we'll look at where things stand, especially when it comes to the battered European economies, many facing energy shortfalls, or majority of them, coming before the upcoming winter season ahead. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. From the International Action Center, Sarah Flounders joins us from New York. Also joining us is contributor at the Schiller Institute, Karel Maris-Ken, who joins us from Paris.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome you both. Sarah Flounders, let me first start with you. Trying to keep up with the pace, let alone the numbers, in terms of the dollar amount from the U.S. in the form of military support for Ukraine. Another one, $775 million, $9 billion since the conflict began, and is part of a huge $40 or $50 billion military package. What do you make of this massive military support that the U.S. is sending, which is said to be a largest arms transfer in U.S. history by some accounts?
Is this to me?
Yes, Sarah Flounders.
Well, it is an enormous, enormous subsidy to U.S. arms manufacturers. That's what it is, first and foremost. It's not meant in any defense of the people of Ukraine, who are being used as pawns in a proxy war. And it is devastating for them. It's also devastating right back here. But it is a U.S. instigated effort to recap their hegemony in the world, which is rapidly fading. And so they are willing to pump billions and billions of dollars, which are payments, as I say, to the military industries here at great profit, and ship some of it. A lot of it just gets lost, resold, repackaged, but some of it gets shipped to the Ukraine. And at the same time, it is creating enormous economic hardship in Europe, because the sanctions, which go right along with the weapons packages, are devastating throughout the world. And it's meant to create hardship, but that is what the U.S. is willing to do in an effort to recapture its position.
Well, let's talk a little bit, Carell, if we can, about what the U.S. has sent in this latest batch. And I'm particularly zooming in on these launchers by the name of HIMARS, which are not the typical, launch vehicles that were used prior, but now recently the U.S. has actually sent it as part of their military package, 16 to be the latest batch, because the U.S. has actually limited that number, fearing that it's going to maybe lead to the U.S. endangering its own national security. It's pretty astounding that the U.S. is going to such limits to provide Ukraine with military assistance, isn't it, when it's looking at equipment that may actually endanger U.S.'s own national security?
Well, it does, because many wars, world wars, can also start very easily by errors of evaluation. And, of course, the French Caesar cannons are already a problem, although their reach is a little bit shorter. The HIMARS, and also the especially because they imply a lot of intelligence and assistance with radar equipment, and they're in reality, according to certain sources, there have been already strikes of by these weapon system on Russian territory itself, and then also in Crimea, which Ukraine will still pretend it is part of Ukraine, while in reality Crimea has decided to join the Russian Federation. So it is an escalation towards making Russia and also Europe co-belligerent actors in the war. And it is only the cold blood the calculation of the Russian military, which so far has kept things on a low level. Also, the HIMARS was used to eliminate the about 100 or at least half of the 100 arrested military forces of the Azov Brigade, which were in a special prison, and which, of course, were not eliminated by the Russians themselves, because they were set to speak before the tribunal and to tell what really happened. And they most probably, most likely, were eliminated with a strike from a missile to prevent them from speaking up.
All right. There's something that's really, I'm not too sure what to make of it. I'm going to call it, in a sense, shocking, Sarah Flounders, that came from the Pentagon. And I'd like to find out if you can make this out. The Pentagon has come out within the same setting, saying that right now, there, according to the statement, a complete and total lack of progress has been made by the Russians on the battlefield. But then the same organization and the person from the Pentagon has said, when pressed by the reporters, that the Ukrainians lacked sufficient troops and combat power to drive the Russians from their defensive positions. This is a complete contradiction and contrast to the stance that the Pentagon has claimed within one setting. What do you make of it?
Well, I think I would make the same thing. Were the statements any different on Afghanistan, right until the day before the U.S. was driven out. They were winning. They claimed it again and again in every public relations statement, and they demanded that Afghan officials also say the situation is being reversed. Didn't mean that it was. And so we've always seen this declaration of victory being just around the corner when, in fact, that's not what's happening. And as long as they can sell the weapons, pump the weapons in, as far as they are concerned, they're winning. They must find wars in order to make the super profits that the military industries are really built on. And they must justify the wars. So that really becomes a self-perpetuating claim. And it is very difficult to know what's actually happening from anything in the U.S. media, because they intentionally don't explain the reason for the war and what's happening on the ground. And at the same time, they claim to care a great deal about the people of the Ukraine. They really are into totally using the people of the Ukraine and organizing and funding for years fascist or Nazi forces in the Ukraine.
Carell, if I can ask you about this, it's almost the same question, but when we look at the numbers and the different analysis on Ukraine's military might, there seems to be consensus on the fact that there's not enough manpower to defend Ukraine or to even be offensive against Russia, but that Ukraine needs equipment. The president has said that. So this kind of puts the focus on the equipment side of things. But we're talking about nuclear-powered Russia. The president has said, Vladimir Putin, nuclear weapons will not be used. But if pressed, and especially if they're looking after Crimea in what's supposed to be this big counteroffensive, do you think there's a possibility that that risks Russia using nuclear weapons of some kind?
Well, I don't have a crystal ball to really predict that this will happen or not. It is, in reality, what Sarah Flanders is saying is true. We're all being lied already on the initial strategy of Russia. Russia never intended to, and that's why they say it's a military operations, because in reality they don't want to invade the entirety of Ukraine and occupy it forever. You know, that's not absolutely not their aim. Secondly, according to the best estimates from the French military and U.S. military, it's there are three times more Ukrainian soldiers than Russian soldiers. So it's a pure lie to say that in terms of numbers, Ukrainians have much more people, which they are very badly trained and low qualified, but they have more people. That's true. And Russia is just taking time to let things work out and is expecting that at one point or another it will be very simply things will run out. And there is an inside division in the U.S., as we have seen with the declaration of Henry Kissinger, which is not my favorite at all, but who is somehow a realist, including a realist for U.S. strategic interests, where he said, you know, that Biden administration is bringing the U.S. in a war with Russia and China into things which the U.S. has partly played on, but nobody knows how this is going to end. So even people like Kissinger, which are not real humanists, you know, are afraid that this whole thing could go out of control, and that at one point or another, there was a call by former U.S. military, the most lunatic elements, which were calling for increased weaponry and increasing, it's not only the quantity, but increasingly more offensive weapons. And that will at one point be used directly against Belarus and Russia. And at that point, then, of course, indeed, Russia could use nuclear strike as an answer. So this is we're we're sleepwalking into a big conflict if there is no wake-up call to get this thing under control.
Our guest talks about how things are getting to the point where it's out of control, Sarah Flounders, but aren't things out of control right now when you're looking at, for example, incidents that concerns Germany, where Gazprom has again announced another halt to its gas flow to Germany. Reports of Germany being deindustrialized and that they need to ration electricity. I mean, that to me sounds like things have gotten out of control just on one European country. What do you think?
Things are certainly out of control within the European economy. Britain also. They're feeling the impact of the sanctions that have boomeranged back on them. It's also hitting here, not as sharply right now, but we're feeling it also. Russia, who is self-sufficient in grain, in energy, in cereals, and a lot of resources, and a great deal of industrial infrastructure, is able to survive these very harsh sanctions and is setting up new banking transactions with other countries. On the other hand, the European Union suddenly finds itself without energy that they absolutely need to fuel their industries and homes and heating and air conditioning and everything that you need in summer and winter. And every single country is feeling the shortages with crazy messages to the populations to shower less and turn out your lights and so on. This won't solve the problems in Europe, but it really means that the sanctions are coming back and hitting them hard because they don't have an alternative to the gas and the oil that they previously exported and used in great quantity and at great advantageous to their own industries. And this is what the U.S. wants to break, because there was 10 times more trade, for example, between Germany and Russia than with the U.S. Well, they want to reverse that and close the door on trade with Russia. It is devastating for the German economy and most of the other countries in Europe that are going along with the sanctions.
Still don't understand how this can actually happen, Carell, when we take a look at the fact that there's still European countries that are purchasing gas and oil from Russia. Germany is still doing that. The Netherlands is still doing that. There are many others that are still doing that with that scheme of how they need to, exchange the euros into rubles and deposit it in one of the Russian banks, Gazprom, I believe. So, you know, that doesn't go with the way that the EU is promoting its all-out sanctions war with Russia. What do you make of that?
Well, it's and it reveals the completely hypocritical system which this EU has become, because they are facing, officially they want to have an embargo, but in practice they will, it will take months and years. And even then, you know, we have, there's a lot of oil bought from India, which is shipped somewhere else, and then it ends up even back in the United States, you know. So the whole facade of things, I mean, this is the craziness of things. They decide things which are absolutely impossible to put into practice, and because they, for example, Renault, you know, the French car industry, they sold their assets for a symbolical sum of money, sold it to the Russians, but they have a special deal that they can buy it back for the same price in the next 6 years, because they expect at that point, you know, maybe the war will be ended and things could be back to normal. So there is but there is a real clash between the political elites, which are completely insane, and the other on the side, the real people and the economic interests, even the, which are really in shock, and also because the sanctions will not only hit Europe, but a lot of countries to which Europe, if you take, for example, Cambodia, you know, they buy 60%. If they have to apply the sanctions, you know, this will completely screw up supply lines for the entire Western economy. So it's, and I'm not even speaking about the food riots, which can happen any day at this point.
August 18, 2022, Sarah Flanders, Diplomacy Watch. Talks to end the war are back on the agenda. This is what one of the headline reads, confirmed by some other ones. However, actions speak louder than words when you hear about the $785 million of weaponry that the U.S. sold. Doesn't sound like diplomacy is back on the agenda or on the table. But in the bigger picture, 6 months, how much diplomacy was on that scale on the left, and how much military talk of war was on the other side of the scale? Why wasn't there such a push for a diplomatic solution to this conflict, do you think?
Well, frankly, the U.S. is not interested in a diplomatic solution anywhere in the world. And every treaty, every agreement they have ever made, they have violated. This is true whether it's Iran or Russia or China or the indigenous nations of the U.S. or the countries of Latin America. They do use diplomacy from time to time, but only in terms of aggressively planning the next wars. And their interest, their bottom line interest, is in using their military and economic power to maintain their world domination. That is what is slipping, because countries around the world have reached a certain industrial and technical capacity to trade and exchange with each other. That is a big change. Before this, the dollar was all powerful, and there was no way, once you were cut off from the SWIFT banking, to do some of the simplest transactions. But now, countries have found there's all forms of digital currency. In China with the SWIFT, the SIPS, CIPS, in Russia with the SPSF, there's mere credit cards. There's all kinds of ways that countries are finding to arrange exchanges for the resources that they need outside of the sanctions that are being imposed by the U.S. as an effort to shut this down. They want each country on their own to starve. That is the purpose of sanctions, is to inflict the greatest pain on the civilian population. And countries are finding ways to survive, to exchange, to trade with each other. And it's the sanctioned countries that are actually showing the way, showing that they can survive determination internally and exchange with each other.
Thank you for that. I'm sorry to jump in. Sarah Flanders, International Action Center, Karel Barik, again, I'm a contributor of the Schiller Institute. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikova Tahwe, it's goodbye until next time.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website,
www.parstoday.com/en.
The imperial hubris on display in the use of such lingo towards poor nations can't hide America's own failures, says Belen Fernandez, journalist, in an article published under the heading, Trump likening the U.S. to a third world country is something everyone agrees on. Here's more. When on August 8, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, FBI, raided Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate in Florida in search of classified documents, the ex-president of the United States decried the episode as an assault that could only take place in broken third-world countries. He continued to lament that America had now become one of those countries, corrupt at a level not seen before. Trump's son, Donald Trump Jr., chimed in on Twitter with the assessment, "This is what you see happen in third-world banana republics. Never mind that the FBI seizure of secret documents does not fit the corruption bill quite as well as some other characteristics of American democracy. Say, the fact that non-taxpaying billionaires can be president or that the country is run as a crooked, oligarchic corporatocracy." This is not the first time Trump has likened the United States of America to a third world country, which was also his epithet of choice when he lost the 2020 presidential election to Joe Biden. But Trump and co. are not the only members of the U.S. ruling elite to exercise this vocabulary. The January 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol prompted a surge in pejorative third world and banana republic comparisons from everyone, from Biden to George W. Bush, former U.S. leader, and civilized ravager of Afghanistan and Iraq. Indeed, it is impossible to understate the bipartisan imperial hubris that is on the display in the casual deployment of such lingo. By implicitly and unironically mocking underdeveloped nations, the U.S. political establishment appears to have conveniently forgotten the country's own historical role in creating the banana republic phenomenon in the first place and in ensuring that the third world remains, you know, third. The term banana republic was coined in 1904 by American writer O. Henry in reference to the Central American nation of Honduras, which, like neighboring Guatemala, was an early victim of predatory U.S. capitalism and corporate exploitation. The economic and physical well-being of the inhabitants of such lowly nations was naturally of no concern to the hemispheric behemoth, which ensured its unfettered access to regional resources by backing right-wing coups, bloody civil wars, corrupt dictatorships, and death squads. In other words, stuff that was slightly more devastating than and an FBI search of Mar-a-Lago. The Cold War, of course, provided a handy alibi for US-backed killing worldwide from Nicaragua to Angola, while also spawning the Third World designation that would go on to accrue patronizing connotations. Once the menace had been replaced with terrorist menace as the primary US excuse for lethal international interference, the remaining global superpower continued to extend a charitable hand to the impoverished Third World, often via a form of corporate neocolonialism cast as development. And while Trump's recent tantrum about the U.S. as a broken third world country can certainly be filed under expansive category of distastefully cookie things, Trump has said, there is also an unintended element of truth to it. Like it or not, the United States of America fits the third world stereotype in many respects, and not just in terms of its oligarchic style of governance. The United States advertises itself as being at the vanguard of global development, but the nation's healthcare, poverty, and other indicators suggest a policy of willful counter-development instead. Back in 2017, Philip Olson, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty and Human Rights, visited the U.S. for 2 weeks. At the end of his trip, he issued a statement on how he found the country exceptional in ways that are shockingly at odds with its immense wealth and its founding commitment to human rights. Despite managing to spend more money on national defense than China, Russia, the UK, and a bunch of other big spenders combined, the US had some 40 million people living in poverty amid glaring contrast between private wealth and public squalor. As Alston noted, the U.S. was also alone among developed countries in insisting that human rights did not include rights that guard against dying of hunger, dying from a lack of access to affordable healthcare, or growing up in a context of total deprivation. So much for that line from the U.S. Declaration of Independence about inalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It's hard to pursue anything if you're dead. Speaking of death, infant mortality rates in the U.S. are higher than in Cuba, an island that has spent more than 60 years under suffocating U.S. embargo. Trump himself imposed no fewer than 243 new sanctions against Cubans as punishment for their crime of pursuing national sovereignty over the banana republic model. And for good measure, threw Cuba back on the U.S. list of state sponsors of terrorism, as the United States baselessly claims. Back in the land of the free, meanwhile, homelessness has reached ghastly levels unseen even in many underdeveloped countries, and the U.S. has long maintained the highest incarceration rate in the world, although it may have recently been surpassed by El Salvador, another place where U.S. support for human rights has involved backing right-wing state terror. Such is the ironic nature of imperial power, it seems, that the global hegemon responsible for oppressing much of the Third World must also keep a significant portion of its own populace in Third World conditions. As per Trump's twisted logic, any attempt to hold him accountable for anything is evidence that the U.S. is a corrupt and broken Third World country. And while there is no sense in wasting time on Trumpian delusion, we might nonetheless take the opportunity to recall that old saying about the broken clock and to acknowledge that the United States of America is definitively broken.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.